register. Mr. Jaworski, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, as was true in the case argued just before this one, the Attorney General of Texas, the Honorable John Hill, has participated in the preparation of this appeal, as has his staff with us. And in order to avoid the dividing of arguments, he has asked that I present the argument on behalf of the state. I think that perhaps a more accurate description of what this case really involves could hardly be made than a characterization given it by the dissenting judge, who stated that this was an instance of the majority entering fields of purely state and local management. Now, under the provisions of Article 3, Section 28 of the Constitution of Texas, a legislative redistricting board is assembled if the legislature fails to redistrict the state after its first regular session following the publication of each United States decennial census. So the legislature convened in January of 1971 was under a constitutional mandate to provide this redistricting. Now, Texas has a bicameral legislature, and because the legislature had failed to redistrict both houses, of course, any effort at redistricting failed, and as a consequence, the redistricting board was assembled and considered the matter of providing a plan of redistricting the Senate and also a plan of redistricting the lower house. Now, this board is constituted by several elected officials, state officials serving on it. It's the Lieutenant Governor, the Speaker of the House, the Attorney General, the Comptroller of Public Accounts, and the Commissioner of the General Land Office. Now, three or more of these members of the redistricting board may sign whatever plan they agree upon, and it's certified to the Secretary of State, and then it becomes an effective plan. Now, I might say that the House plan is the only one. The plan relating to the representatives is the only plan that's involved on this appeal. Perhaps a brief reference should be made to the commencement of this litigation. After the plans were filed, a suit was instituted in Houston, Texas, by Curtis Graves, a black state representative from Harris County, that's Houston, and which he contended that there was unconstitutional apportionment of the senatorial districts because of an alleged racial gerrymandering, his point being that there should have been a district carved out in which 80% are blacks, and that because one was not carved out in that manner, that it was unconstitutional. And then next came a number of other suits that were filed challenging the board's plan for the House of Representatives in different parts of the state, with different groups filing these suits, and interventions were also filed on behalf of a number of groups. And there was a consolidation of all of these actions, and they were heard before a three-judge court. Now, the court ordered first that unless the legislature of Texas on or before July the 1st of 1973 adopted a plan to reapportion the legislative districts in accordance with the constitutional guidelines set out in the court's opinion, that the court will then proceed to reapportion the state itself. And then the court further ordered that the counties of Dallas, that's where the city of Dallas is, and the county of Bear, that's where San Antonio is, that both of these be reapportioned into single-member representative districts in conformance with a plan of reapportionment that the court provided.
Mr. Jaworski, was injunctive relief granted?
Yes, sir. The injunctive relief... Excuse me, sir. The injunctive relief consisted of the state being restrained from proceeding. The elections could not be held in accordance with the plan that had been filed by the redistricting board. Judge Woods stated very frankly that he wholeheartedly disagreed with his colleagues in declaring the state plan unconstitutional, saying that he could think of nothing that illustrated more vividly the chaos that existed in the area of restructuring the political districts of a state, as was attempted to be done and ordered by the court in this particular instance, to be done by July the 1st, 1973, or else the court's plan had to be adopted. Now, of course, the Mahon versus Howell case is very significant. A number of the court's pronouncements in that case are quite applicable here. Perhaps I should point out that what the majority did in our case was relied on the Kirkpatrick versus Chrysler case, repeatedly referring to it. Also on Wells versus Rockefeller, both of which, as we know, are congressional redistricting cases.
Mr. Jaworski, hasn't the court said at least once and perhaps more often that a great deal more flexibility is permitted in the state legislature than in congressional districts?
That's what this court, of course, said in the Mahon-Howell case.
Well, we said it before that.
And also said it, yes, sir, in the Reynolds versus
Reynolds against Sims.
Right, sir. But it was quite well emphasized in a case that was decided or
rather. So there was nothing new in Mahon against Howell in that respect?
No, I don't think so. I think it did some re-emphasizing that perhaps, and having come so recently, is something that we might talk about a little more, but I mean as counsel, but certainly there was nothing new in it. The interesting thing is that Judge Wood, who so strongly dissented in this case from the actual majority, recognized that difference in his dissenting opinion. And he recognized the difference between congressional districts and legislative districts, pointing to the cases, pointing to Reynolds versus Sims. Now, what the majority did here was required, first, a much stricter standard of state legislative reapportionment, permissible deviation, and had been approved theretofore. Actually, in this case, the total variation of 9.9% under the board was unquestioned as far as a majority opinion was concerned. I noticed where in one of the briefs some question was raised whether that might be entirely accurate, but there had been nothing before the lower court that raised any question beyond that of it being assumed and considered that the total variation was only 9.9%. Now, this was under the board's redistricting plan. I should point out that the average variation was only 1.82%. Now, one of the problems in this case, a matter on which so very much stress was laid by a majority of the court, which in our view led the court exactly to nothing as far as the end result was concerned, were the procedural niceties that were followed by this board. There were several things that took place. Of course, these men, all of them, had to depend upon staff assistance because they had other duties to perform as state officials. And they did have considerable staff assistance, perhaps the one official who participated more than anyone else in this particular matter was the Attorney General himself, who counseled with the redistricting board constantly on what should be done, and also letting him know on what was permissibly legal as he interpreted the decisions. But the court has gone to considerable extent in talking about not the end result so much as these procedures that was employed and finding fault with them and finding fault with the particular assistance that had been rendered by members of the staff and such as that, forgetting, it seemed to me, at least for a moment, that even judges need the assistance or at least utilize the assistance of law clerks at times. But there also, it is very clear, was a complete misapprehension of what Whitcomb versus Chavis actually said. What the court here did was not only, as indicated, went into the matter of redistricting the entire state, but also found fault with what had been done specifically insofar as single and multi-member districts were concerned in the two counties that I mentioned. What the court failed to do, as we see it, was to employ the equal protection test, that a state must make an honest and a good faith effort to construct the districts as nearly of equal population as is practicable. And there is nothing here to indicate in this record that this good faith effort was not made. Now, let me digress for a moment, if I may, because I've noted that there were some references made in some of the briefs to some alleged evidence in this case that, frankly, is no evidence. What happened at the outset was that the chief judge of this three-judge court, the presiding judge, announced that everything that was offered by anyone would be admitted in evidence. He didn't want us to even make any objections. If the matter was conjectural, if it was hearsay or whatever the proper objection may have been, it went into the record anyway. The announcement being that the court would at the end consider those things that were admissible and those matters that were not admissible. But there were no rulings ever made by the court. And as a consequence, the floodgates were opened and everybody who had anything that he wanted to bring before the court just introduced it in evidence and it was received. We don't know actually what the court did consider and what it didn't consider, speaking of the majority. But we do know that there were some matters tendered here that were not admissible in evidence and that the record presently is cluttered with some of those matters. I mention that simply because what should really be a relatively easy case to discuss with the court, and the issues being well-defined as we see it, is complicated a little because of some of the references that have been made in some of the briefs to what the evidence purportedly showed. Now, the court, the majority, apparently everywhere, just placed the burden upon the state. It made note to show that there was inequality of any kind, that there was no discrimination of any kind, that there wasn't any type of delusion, and had us carry the burden throughout the case. So far as I can tell, we discharged the burden, although it's questionable as to whether we had the burden in all of these instances. Now, Texas is a large state, as is known. We'll not engage in talking about how large it is. But it's not only a large one, but it also has a shape. That does not render it very easily susceptible to the division among districts. So some problem is going to be encountered. But we actually, what was necessary here were, well, let me say first, the ideal district was about 74,000 plus. There were 150 representatives to be elected to the lower house. And a large number of districts had to be carved out. In addition to it, this particular board was confronted with a decision, with the provision of the Constitution of our state, which had been interpreted in the case of Craddock versus Smith, which we cite in our brief. And under that, county lines could not be crossed, unless it were absolutely necessary to do it in order to make up this district of 74,000, the ideal. It also required that it go to a contiguous county if it were necessary to do that. Texas, as we know, and as the court doubtless knows, not only has its large metropolitan cities, but it has rural areas. It has large areas that are very sparsely settled. Now, actually, there was no instance in which our constitutional requirements and the integrity that was required for this board to follow was not carefully embraced in each instance, with the possible exception, well, with the exception of Red River County. And there we had a real problem up in the part that adjoins Arkansas with the Red River, and between the two of them had a problem as to Bowie County. So what was actually done is that in that one instance, the county line was crossed. Now, the total population, incidentally, as the court probably has already gathered from what I had said, is, according to the last census, about 11,200,000. The senatorial district's not involved here, but may be of interest to the court, is of approximately 360,000 to 368,000. Now, if we were to draw comparisons here, and I do this only because the case has just been decided by this court, and to show a similarity of the situations, if I may review those, in Virginia, there was a total variation of 16.4. Under what the board did here, a total variation of 9.9. An average variation in the Mahan case of 3.89. in Texas of 1.82. Within the 4%, there were 35 of the districts in Virginia. In Texas, we had 93 under this board's plan. Those that exceeded 6% were 9 in Virginia. There were none under this board's plan in Texas, and only 2 exceeded 5%. I indicated a few moments ago that it was our view that Whitcomb versus Chavez had been misinterpreted, and we do feel that that is definitely in the case. I want to mention one effort that was made in particular. There was injected in the case the fact that perhaps difference was that in Indiana, particularly in Marion County, which was involved in the Whitcomb versus Chavez case, that there was no racial history. And the suggestion was made that Texas had a racial history. There's no one that would deny that Texas, as is true with so many of the states, has a racial legacy. It is untrue that there is any showing whatever that there has been any such happenings, any sort of racial violation with respect to the electoral process in our state. The last one, according to the testimony in this case, undisputed and coming from a witness who appeared on behalf of the appellees, was back in 1956. So that this is really not in the case, despite the fact the witness was put on the stand to testify that or undertake to testify, and this is one of the particular matters to which I refer that has made it somewhat difficult to brief and argue this case because the court admitted everything. Man who posed as an expert and undertook to say that there was a difference as far as racial history in Indianapolis and Marion County was concerned and in Texas. And then it turned out, when I asked him the questions on cross-examination, that he had never even been to Indiana, much less Indianapolis, had not made any type of study of the matter. And this is set out in our brief to show what we had to contend with. I should say that there is a stipulation in the record. In order to lay at rest completely the matter of all having been free to engage in our process of registration as well as voting, there is a stipulation that there has been none of that in our state for a number of years, and of course the evidence shows nothing of the kind. Now, we get into another phase that I want to discuss with the court, if I may, and that is what happened with respect to Harris County, Houston. Under the ward's plan, being divided into single-member districts, and what happened insofar as Dallas That's Dallas County, and San Antonio, Bexar County, being multi-member districts. Now, there, of course, is some difference, one could say. Houston, a very large city, 1,700,000, either the fifth or sixth largest city of the nation at the present time. Dallas, 1,000,003, Dallas County. San Antonio, even a much smaller city than that. Traditionally, Dallas has had multi-member districts. Same was true of Bexar County. As far as Houston is concerned, Harris County, the legislators themselves, the delegation from there, more or less favored single-member districts. So on the surface, you might say, well, why does Harris County have single-member districts, and why does Dallas and Bexar County have multi-member districts? Well, it was done without there being the slightest intimation in the record that any individual group sacrificed any constitutional rights by virtue of it. It was done largely because the board had before it witnesses who thought that this was a sensible thing to do in Harris County, had witnesses before it that thought it was a sensible thing to do in Dallas and Bexar County, what was done in those. Now, our position is that absent the showing of something that shows that either voting strength has been diluted or that something has been done that has occasioned the transgression of a constitutional right, that certainly much has been made of nothing. May I say this?
You say the reason, Mr. Jaworski, was historically this has been
No, sir. No, sir. I didn't intend to say that, sir. Okay. I did intend to say that that was true as far as Dallas was concerned, and I believe Bexar County, because they had. But it was not true as far as Harris County is concerned. Harris County had some mixtures in the past. They had plutorial representatives even. I said what really brought it on more than anything else is that delegations should come from these particular areas and the board in sifting what people wanted, what their representatives said they wanted, made these provisions of single-member districts for Houston, for Harris County, multi-member for Dallas, and for Bexar County.
And Dallas and Bexar historically have had multi-member?
Dallas and Bexar historically have had multi-member.
And Houston has also had multi-member plus...
Has had, but also some mixture, Mr. Justice Stewart. There have been mixtures of flatorial representatives and such as that, I recall, voted for some.
Now, wasn't there a state policy expressed somewhere earlier that that you'd have... that the state would have multi-member until the number got to 15. Isn't that somewhere here in the record?
That may have been in the history of.
And that thereafter you'd have.
I do not think that this was a part of what was before the board. Mm-hmm. I do want to make mention of this. Now you take Bexar County for example. This is a county, San Antonio, where a large segment of the population is Mexican-American. Actually, 50% of them are. You don't have a minority there of Mexican-Americans at all. The record shows that if they undertook to exercise the election process, their right to vote, to register and vote, there wouldn't be any problem. The problem has been that less than 30% of them, or approximately 30% of them, seek to exercise that privilege. This is where your trouble has been as far as Bexar County is concerned. I should make mention of this, too, because it's in the record and a matter that probably will be talked about. Dallas County has a strong political party. It's a party that has had on its slate blacks as well as whites. The record shows that they were contemplating three blacks on their record on their slate following this act of redistricting. That they'd had at different levels, that is even including the legislative level, black on the slate before. Now, it is true that it is a strong political organization. It is true that a black placed on that slate probably would be elected. It is also true that a white placed on that slate would be elected. It is also true that if this organization opposed a white, that he would have a hard time being elected, just as much as if the organization opposed a black. While rooted in history, as I answered to Mr. Justice Stewart's question, the matter of multi-member districts has never been used in Dallas, and the record is completely silent. There is nothing to show that multi-member district arrangement for Dallas County was used or conceived either to dilute or to cancel the voting strength of blacks. And I think that this distinguishes it from some other inferences and some pronouncements that have been made by this court in other cases. And I believe with that, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I will wait with the concluding argument until after counsel for the appellees.
Very well, Mr. Jaworski. Mr. Richards?
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice. Let me open with a brief preliminary. We are dividing our 45 minutes between three counsel. I will attempt to open to discuss what we consider to be the underlying irrationality of the state plan and the dilution of the Negro vote in Dallas County. Mr. Edar will follow discussing the underlying distinctions we think on this record between Whitcomb versus Chavez and the impact of the at-large scheme on the Mexican-American minority of Bexar County. Mr. G, on behalf of the State Republican Party, will follow to discuss everything we forget, including jurisdiction, and I think the inordinate costs of election campaigns in the counties with which we're discussing. As a preliminary matter, the order below is it was a complicated four lawsuits consolidated with various contentions. I guess the order below is of two parts. There is a declaratory judgment, which does speak to the statewide apportionment plan. But that was not effectuated by injunction, but rather was left to be operative only in July of this year in the event the legislature did not address themselves to it. There was injunctive relief. It was narrow. It affected only two counties in the state of Texas, those counties of Dallas and Bexar. Their single-member district plans were implemented by the court unanimously. Judge Wood, who did dissent from the other portions of the court's opinion below, agreed that this was so egregious in Dallas and Bexar County that implementation of immediate single-member districts was in order. So we think the jurisdictional issue is in the case, and Mr. G will address himself to it. The root problem that confronted the Texas legislature redistricting board, when it began to consider reapportionment of the Texas legislature, was what to do with the urban counties. The testimony is clear that this was, in the words of one witness, a raging controversy across the state of Texas. Hearings were held by the Legislative Redistricting Board on two occasions concerning what was to be done. All of the witnesses who appeared were concerned only with this single issue. Urban counties of Dallas, Bexar, and Harris, were they to be divided into individual districts or something less than at large, or were they to be left at large? Now, the board, in remains an utterly unarticulated decision, decided to divide Harris County into 23 individual member districts and to leave Dallas and Bexar County running at large. Dallas has become what we all, I think, recognize to be the largest legislative district in the nation's history. 18 legislators elected from at-large from a county of 1,400,000 people. No requirement of geographic distribution. They could all come from one city block within the city of Dallas. Now, the peculiarity here, quite granted there was a history of at-large representation in the urban cities of Texas. It was true of all the cities of Texas until 1965, when the Texas legislature did for the first time apportion Harris County, Houston, into something less than countywide districts. At that time, in Kilgarland versus Martin, The state of Texas explained to the federal courts that a policy existed. And that policy was that any time a county became of 1 million in size or more than 15 legislators, it became simply unworkable to run at large. And that in the future, then, any time a county became that size, that county itself would be apportioned down into something less than at-large representation. Well, when Dallas County hit 1.4 million this year, larger than Harris was in 65, that policy went by the board without even a whisper of, on the part of the board members of this legislative redistricting board, three of whom had been defendants in the Kilgarden case, who presumably had sponsored that explanation for the, at that time, for the apportionment of Harris County. At no time, although now in their reply brief, the court, the appellants say that that really never was a policy, they certainly never told the court that. The court's opinion said it was a policy. And when the appeal papers were filed here, there's no indication of any disclaimer of that policy when Kilgarden versus Martin was considered here as Kilgarden versus Hill. The only reason that appears ever for this rather curious treatment of the two counties was in the jurisdictional statement filed by the appellants, and they suggested there that the reason they left Dallas County at large was that the dominant Democratic organization in Dallas County preferred to take a winner-take-all election. They have not sponsored that as their reason in their subsequent briefs. We talked about the board procedures in our briefs, and we did deal with it, not because we want to go behind the board, or not because we want to indict what they did because they did it in a sloppy manner, but because it points to no rational state policy that underlies this very crucial decision in terms of how people are going to be elected in a county the size of Dallas. 500,000 registered voters in that county, to which any person who seeks to be elected to the legislature must somehow communicate. The last general primary election ballot in Dallas had 68 races on it, 3+ congressional seats, 3+ state senate seats, and a submerged 15-member legislative delegation. The results of this rather whimsical, if you will, if not venal, decision with respect to Dallas, of course, is to isolate the black minority of that city, which has suffered a traditional isolation that this record speaks to quite strongly, into simply an intolerable bind. There is no relief. Texas remains a one-party state. This is not a situation such as Indiana, in which conceivably the explanation for the underrepresentation of the ghetto was winning and losing elections in November. What happens in Texas is you win or lose in the Democratic primary. The Democratic primary is a majority place system. That means in order to obtain the nomination, you must, if you are a black candidate, ultimately be pitted vis-a-vis a white candidate in a county in which racial segregation, discrimination, has still been the order of the day. Granted, it diminishes, but as this record establishes, it diminishes rather slowly. And what this record further shows is that the dominant political organization of that county, the DCRG, when circumstances require and their candidates are threatened by a black candidate or by a candidate that has the support of the Negro minority, they simply trot out the old game of race in order to win. In 1970, two candidates made it into the runoff, Democratic primary runoff, against the DCRG candidates, the DCRG being a private sort of modern-day Jaybird Association, as far as we're concerned. In that runoff, the DCRG mailed to the white voters of Dallas County literature saying block voting tactics will take place in the South Dallas, the Negro area of Dallas, if you don't get out to the polls and vote. And it said the philosophy of these candidates is best described by the enclosed. One of the candidates was white. In the previous year, he had sent out a mailing for a biracial voter registration activity. It was this philosophy that the DCRG, which runs Dallas County politics, concluded was the most effective way to appeal to the voters of Dallas County, and it was quite effective. The other tool they used, they simply used a picture of the black candidate contrasted with his white opponent. It was quite effective, as I say, in the black precincts of Dallas. These candidates, white and black, got 90% and 87% of the vote. They were obliterated in the white precincts and were defeated very sizably. Now, that's the reality, the political reality this record establishes, as we see it, to the black minority of Dallas County. Establishes, we see, well, it's fostered, as we see it, by other factors. The massive size of the legislative district is such, there is simply no way that a candidate can address himself to that electorate without enormous financing. The record ranges estimates to run a state legislative race from anywhere from $60,000 to $125,000. This means that only if a candidate has that kind of financing could he ever even expect to receive individualized consideration in the race as a legislative candidate. The effect of it has been to really prevent the emergence of a two-party system in Texas. The record, although it may be a little shocking, but that's what the record is, that the Republican Party in Dallas has been unable and unwilling to mount serious legislative races in November simply because the financing is beyond their means. And so what we have is, again, a one-party system, determinations being made in the Democratic primary, and a majority place system in a primary that continues to be dominated by a white oligarchy that has not permitted black participation.
Let's assume for the moment that the validity of the entire state plan is here. Assume we have jurisdiction of the part of the issue. The district court upset the entire plan based on
three theories.
Three things. One, variation.
Deviation. Just straight deviation.
Now, did that variation on the numbers reach Harris, Dallas, and Bexar counties? What if the multi-member district issue had not been here?
The deviation of the two major districts, Harris and Bexar, was not central to the court's decision on deviation, if I make myself clear. The way the deviation was calculated in those two counties was simply dividing the number of legislators.
Some parts of the plan were invalidated solely on deviation.
Some parts were, but not those parts dealing with the multi-member, single-member district issue. Some parts of the plan, I don't think it's purely deviation. I think if I read the court's opinion correctly, what we have is the state sponsoring an explanation, a county line explanation as being the justification for the deviation, but once you go behind that explanation and look to the plan, you think it just doesn't make sense.
But now on the multi-member district rationale, that was because Harris was divided and the other metropolitan areas were not.
Yes, in part. Indeed, there are two strings to that, I suppose, the irrationality. Why cut Harris and leave Dallas and Bexar at large for no apparent reason? Two, the effect of that is the leaving of those two at large was to minimize, dilute, or oppress the minority vote in those two.
But there were other metropolitan areas that had multi-member districts.
There were, and the
And they didn't touch those.
And that's, I suppose, a shortcoming on the part of the plaintiffs. This case was tried in a...
Yeah, but that was because there wasn't any finding with respect to racial
There was
impact.
No evidence offered or findings made with respect to racial impact as regards the other multi-member districts in the state. And the reason was, and it is of record, that this case was put together and tried in a compressed period of time, and we stated very frankly to the court we weren't conceding the legitimacy of the others, but we simply could not muster the proof in the time frame with which we were operating.
Absent, other than the racial item, the district court would have contemplated handling all metropolitan areas the same one way or another. Absent the racial.
Well, they didn't do that, and they didn't, I'm not
but
sure.
Eventually, they would have.
That may or may not be a fair construction of the opinion. I suppose they clearly would have in the event evidence came forward in terms of racial or ethnic discrimination. Quite clearly, yes, they would have considered it. Whether they would have, in absence of such evidence or findings, implemented single-member districts, I can't second-guess them on.
Left existing what they said was an irrational.
Well, right, and we might have been able. In all candor, I suppose we would be back to the court saying you ought to cut the rest of them up. I don't want to be dishonest with the court, but they didn't do it. The contentions weren't there. And how they would react if and when we were back in court making that contention, I can't tell you. There is a difference in my mind between a multi-member district that elects of a county of 150,000, electing two legislators, and a multi-member district of 1,000,004, electing 18, simply in the capacity to isolate the minority. The inertia alone is a force, it seems to me, when it becomes that size.
Would you refresh my recollection, Mr. Richards, as to how many representatives Harris had? How
23.
Many? Harris had 23. Bayer had how many?
11. Dallas, 18.
Dallas, 18.
And one of the ironies, I guess, in the plan was that in Bear County, one of those counties left at large, and presumably all operating pursuant to a state policy of preserving county lines, the board, for some reason, cut a piece out of Bear County, attached it to a rural district, for no reason that this record will explain. It worsened the deviation, as a matter of fact, that would have been resulted had it been left intact. And I suppose it was whimsical things of this nature which caused or capricious, I suppose is a better word, caused, I believe, the lower court to find that there was simply no rational purpose underlying this plan, clearly no rational purpose as far as the at-large representation in the urban counties. Or stated the other way, the at-large representation in the urban counties in no way fostered a state purpose of preserving county lines. Indeed, of the 11 counties that were left at large, 8 of them were actually cut. Their county lines and portions of the county removed and allocated to other districts.
Something you said prompts me to ask this question, and I'll try not to take too much time with it. Suppose in a large county like Harris, it was demonstrable that there was no racial problem at all, but that Republicans were concentrated in certain areas and Democrats in the larger areas. And that the Democrats, in an at-large situation, could dominate it indefinitely, electing all of their party members. Do you think that gives rise to a constitutional problem?
The court below did not think so. Refused to find so, although that contention is made.
Has this court ever indicated that there's a constitutional issue in that kind of situation?
Well, there's dicta in at least certain opinions of this court suggesting that if the plan diluted, as I recall, racial or political minorities, that it might be invalidated under the Equal Protection Clause. If not so held, as I understand.
But it hasn't been held.
That's my impression.
Suppose the Catholics, for example, were concentrated in one area and non-Catholics of all kinds in another. Would you say that gives rise to a constitutional problem?
If there were historical exclusions from the Catholics from the franchise and from every aspect of life in that community, I would say
I would suspect so. I'm not assuming any of that.
We're not here arguing, I don't mean to suggest that we are, that only blacks can represent blacks or only Catholics can represent Catholics, or that there is an entitlement to a representation of a sort of vertical of someone of my like kind. We're simply arguing that this system on this record establishes the kind of dilution that this court said it would invalidate when it saw.
Yes, on this religious hypothesis that I gave you,
conceivably it could rise to the dignity of a constitutional question.
I assume it's a reality that people who are Catholics tend to want to live in areas where there are Catholic churches, or if there are none, to build them. And so it's not surprising if they happen to be concentrated, is it?
I would think such concentrations certainly do exist. I think that's clear.
But you see no constitutional...
Well, I guess I'm not saying I see none. I simply see that I don't have to carry that burden,
I'm just trying to see how far this problem of dealing with abstract minorities is carried.
Yeah, of course, at least we feel we're dealing with a precise minority that comes in a context that we think demonstrates how it can be submerged.
The court has used the term identifiable minority.
And I think, and Texas identified that minority by its statutes, by its practices and policies for a number of years, and is just finally beginning to cease identifying. Now, having identified the minority, I suppose they are stuck with it.
Dallas County, how has there been any racial discrimination in voting of any kind in Dallas County since April 14, 1944?
If you mean, Your Honor, well, if you mean, the record would show that in 1956 there is testimony that black voters presented themselves at the polls in a Democratic primary in Dallas and were told they could not vote there. I would not suggest to you, however, that that has been the case. I think the case has been the poll tax, the case has been the substitution for the poll tax, the annual registration system, I think the record will show other factors which, in fact, did deter black voting. And I think the poll tax being the most clearest, the clearest one of that case. But physical intimidation, we did not argue, and did not argue that physical intimidation or blocking.
Well, haven't they been voting since April 14, 1944?
Mr. Justice Marshall, I am simply not informed. There has been, I'm not informed. I'm sorry to say. I participated in Dallas politics for a number of years.
I'm just trying to get the statements you said in an atmosphere where there had been racial discrimination in voting. And you put Dallas in that category.
I'm sorry. If I said it in that way, I guess I meant in voting. I don't know. I meant racial discrimination. Blacks in Dallas were segregated by law well into the decade of the 60s or the 50s, and by practice into the 60s.
If I remember correctly, the Dallas segregation ordinance was thrown out in the 1940s.
I participated in a stand-in in Dallas in the mid-1960s.
Against an ordinance?
No, against a policy. But we still had segregation
policy.
In the jail. We had segregation in the Dallas County Jail as recently as 3 or 4 years ago. The record will show there's still black and white drinking fountains in the county courthouse up until 4 years ago.
Well, if we want to apply this rule in every state that has segregated jails, what?
Thank you.
Mr. Edar.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Pursuing the matter that has just been raised, I think that for our part, we would like to stress that we conceive of the right to vote as going far beyond merely casting a ballot, marking it and casting, and this court has so held. And our position here, primarily as to Bexar County, is that because of certain statutes in Texas, our minority in Bexar County has been totally submerged. Now, I would like to point out that the lower court found that race is still an important issue in Bexar County, and that because of it, Mexican Americans are frozen into permanent political minorities destined for constant defeat at the hands of the controlling political majority. Now, I will emphasize that this is a finding made by three judges who have spent their entire life in Texas, one of them being Judge Wood from San Antonio. Now, I would like to stress on the multi-member district issue that as far as the Legislative Redistricting Board, when it initiated its work on the House redistricting plan, it expressly had before it certain cautionary language on the part of the Texas Supreme Court in the case of Mosse versus the Legislative Redistricting Board, which is the one that mandamus the board to redistrict the House. The Texas Supreme Court, who presumably is familiar with the demography of our state, of our municipalities, our metropolitan areas, of the distribution and concentration of the minority groups, expressly stated as follows. In exercising its discretion as to whether to create multi-member districts within a single county, we must assume that the board will give careful consideration to the question of whether or not the creation of any particular multi-member district would result in discrimination by minimizing the voting strength of any political or racial elements of the voting population. Now, I would like to point out to this court that it is on the record that from 1880 to 1970, there was only 5 Mexican Americans had been elected to the Texas House, one of them in 1890, 4 of them since 1961. I would further stress that between 1960 and 1970, and this is part of the record, and it is uncontroverted, out of 133 races in the Democratic Party primaries, only 22 were entered by Mexican Americans. And of course, as I've already stated, only 4 were actually elected during that period. Now, from the particular area where the Mexican American is concentrated in San Antonio, which is on the record as a 28 contiguous census tract area, Only four candidates ran from that area between 1960 and 1970. Two Mexican-Americans, one Negro, one Anglo-American. Now, I cannot overstress what Mr. Richards touched upon, and that is the size of the multi-member districts that we are dealing with. Bexar County, 830,460 population, the city of San Antonio, 654,000, is larger than 17 of the 132 countries in the United Nations. It is larger than the combined population of four of those countries. It is larger than 11 states that elect 22 United States senators. It has a land area larger than the state of Rhode Island, 1,246 square miles. It is larger both in land area and population than the District of Columbia. Four senators are elected from states that have a total population less than Bexar County. Now, contrasting that...
Yes, you will touch upon the suggestion made by your opposition that the one of the reasons is that the Mexican Americans don't turn out to vote.
We don't vote. I think we have to. That's where the racial history of our state comes into play, Your Honor. And I would like to stress that since 1966 through 1972, we have had six federal court decisions dealing with the political, with the electoral system in Texas, five of those between 1970 and 1972. The poll tax was set aside in 1966, the excessive filing fee requirement in 1970, the 6 months residency requirement in 1972, the over in Crystal City, a small town in South Texas, and local city charter provision requiring property ownership for election to city office was set aside by a single judge district court. In the case of Garza versus Smith in 1971, certain provisions in the Texas Electoral Code denying the right to illiterate voters to have an election judge help them mark the ballot was set aside on the grounds that that same right was not denied to blind or physically disabled voters. Now, when I touch upon illiteracy, in that case, I must point out that persons that may be illiterate in English are not necessarily illiterate persons, because they do speak and read Spanish and they do follow Spanish radio and television, and they do have the means at hand to form political judgments. We have had, in addition to that, since 1971, three decisions having to do with jury service, the denial of opportunity to serve on juries, and we have had six decisions since 1970 dealing with education. One of them is now before this court, which is the one involving the Rodriguez case in the Edgewood School District in San Antonio on school finance. So, in reply to that question, why don't we vote? We need to assess the situation of the Mexican-American as it has developed in the history of this country, as late as 1972. We cannot wipe all of these hindrances and then overnight expect the injured group to be able to compete on an equal footing with those people who have never been hindered. And when you throw them into the type of multi-member district county that we have, where they have to compete in an area of over 1,000 square miles, where they have to appeal to an electorate that is close to a million voters, where they have to raise the finances. And I'm not minimizing the fact that the record in our brief makes some profuse references to economic, educational, and any number of other factors that have been adverse to the Mexican-American population. We cannot equate numbers simply with the denial of a right. I think a minority constitutionally isn't defined purely on the basis of numbers. So my position is, our position is, that because of these hindrances, true, we don't vote to the extent that other people have done so. Incidentally, I forgot to mention that another part of the record is that the Anglo-American population in Bexar County will vote on a ratio of 6-1 to 9-1 against Mexican-American candidates. I might further point out that as a result of the single-member districts that were imposed on the county, or that were ordered for the county by the trial court, at the time the case was tried, out of 10 representatives from Bexar County to the state legislature, 9 were Anglo-American, none was black or Negro, and none were Republican, and only one was of mixed Mexican and Anglo-American parentage. Today, as a result of last year's elections, there are 4 Mexican-Americans, 1 Negro, and 2 Republicans. In Dallas County, today we have 3... Well, of course, you're Mexican-Americans and the black or Negro or Democrats. Yes.
But what about how many? So that's out of 11, is it?
Out of 11. That would make 8 Democrats. I'm sorry, 10 Democrats, because it's only 2 Republicans were elected.
Yes, but there were 4 Mexican-Americans.
1 black or Negro and 2 Republicans.
So it's 5 out of the 11 were Mexican-Americans or Negro. Is that
yes.
Right?
Yes, you know.
And is that what you would expect out of single-member districts doing that they are?
Not necessarily, because we recognize that a single-member district is no millennium, it's no panacea.
I would suppose that you probably had a majority, an actual head count majority in other single-member districts.
In some of them, yes, Your Honor. In others...
But again, your failure to register and vote may have lost. In some single members.
In the ones where no Mexican Americans were elected, I don't know that we had any Mexican Americans running in any of those other races. I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think they were mostly concentrated in those districts where they felt they had an opportunity, whether or not they had a substantial majority of the vote. But our argument here is not that we feel entitled to representation as such. Our argument is that we're entitled to participate, to an opportunity to compete, not to be counted out by the cost of running an election, the cost of campaigning, the area in which we have to campaign, by the attitude of the other people or of the opposition. I might stress the fact that as far as the Mexican-American is concerned, there is no need to circulate campaign literature showing what he looks like, because his name makes it pretty self-evident on the ballot. And don't want to vote for a Mexican-American, all you have to do is look at the name on the ballot, and you do not have to resort to overt methods of racial methods, say, for hitting back at your opponent. I would like to make reference to one stipulation that was referred to this court, and that is that the stipulation is on the record that nobody has been denied the right to register and vote. I've already stressed that we feel the right to vote goes far beyond just the right to register and vote, but I would like to stress the stipulation relates only to the named plaintiffs in the lawsuit. Now, we're not hinging our case on denial of the right to register and vote. We are hinging it on the fact that we have been submerged totally in this tremendous multi-member district. I wanted to stress the distinction between this district and Virginia in the Mahan case. Fairfax County, 455,000 population, 10 representatives. And the legislature there, as this court has stated in its opinion, expressly went out of its way not to fragment the county, but to simply divide it so as not to wind up with too large a multi-member district. They wind up with 2 5-member districts. In contrast to that, we have Bexar County with 830,000 population. That's almost twice the size of Fairfax County. And with that, I would like to thank the court and allow Mr. G.
Thank you, Mr. Idar. Mr. G., the argument seems to be made, as I'm following it, that a minority, any kind of a minority, is entitled to have the area
structured so that it can get the maximum amount of representation without respect to whether they do or don't register to vote.
Perish the thought, Mr. Chief Justice.
That
is not our position. Our position is that any minority, except perhaps a political one such as I represent, is entitled not to have the area structured so that they do not have a fair opportunity to participate. We claim no right to any special preference. May it please the Court, I would like to respond very briefly to a question which was asked by Mr. Justice Stewart of Colonel Jaworski. As regards the state policy, the trial court noted at page 21A of the appendix, the jurisdictional statement, in their trial brief, the state asserted, this is the trial brief, may it please your honor, in the Kilgarling case. In their trial brief, the state asserted that the explanation for the differing treatment of Dallas and Harris counties was that whenever a county attained 1 million residents or was allocated 15 legislators and so forth. I would like to respond to one other suggestion made by Colonel Jaworski, and that is that Dallas was multi-membered because of the desires of the citizens there. This record makes it amply clear that the desires of the citizens there, taken by a professional and disinterested poll, which testimony was before the redistricting board, were 2 or 3 to 1 in favor of single-member districts. And that, in fact, the desires of the people in Dallas were not at all for the multi-member plan. The court will find that in the record. In the testimony of Mr. Robertson at page 964 of the record. Now, it falls to me, may it please the court, to attempt to handle in a very short time quite a few things, and I'm going to attempt to move along rather quickly.
And you're going to, what about jurisdiction?
I intend to say a word on that, and I will commence.
Jurisdiction comes rather early in this case, you think?
Customarily, Mr. Justice White, it does. I will attempt to deal with that right now. In the past, this court has, which certainly is the expert on its own jurisdiction in these matters, has held that the three-judge court, as in Moody against Flowers or in the New Left case, must be properly constituted by pleading asking for an injunction having statewide impact.
And you challenge the legitimacy of the three-judge court?
No, not at all. Not at all, Mr. Justice.
So there was a properly constituted three-judge court?
There is no doubt of that, Your Honor.
The only question is whether there was an injunction entered at the time that would
involve
its jurisdiction in this court.
Mr. Justice White, in the Gunn case, this court held that where an injunction was not entered, even though the three-judge court was properly constituted, that this court did not have jurisdiction. Now, it is only a step from that to a holding that the court's jurisdiction is inappropriate in this case, where an injunction which is narrow, which applies to only 2 counties in Texas. No, sir, we have no authority whatsoever, but I suggest that by a melding of what the court has held in the Moody and in New Left with its decision in Gunn. I'm aware of that, Your Honor. However, I would like to point this out to the court.
This is the only jurisdictional question there is.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's assume there is an injunction. Let's assume that we disagreed with you and said that there was jurisdiction. Of what?
Well, of the injunction, which applies to Dallas County and Bexar County, Mr. Justice White, I should say.
And you would say that even if we have jurisdiction, it would not extend to reviewing judgment of the court with respect to the variations?
I would not wish to say that the court's pendant jurisdiction would not extend to that, Mr. Justice White. I will say this, however. If the court intends to hold that by the procedural device of alleging a claim for statewide relief and perhaps contending for only narrow injunctive relief, a complainant can place jurisdiction in this court, whether it will or no, then the court's jurisdiction is likely to be widely extended. I would suggest that if the relief sought here had been only in Dallas and Bexar counties, and the relief sought had been granted, then we would have precisely the same case as regards the practicalities of the matter at this point. It is not the seeking of relief having statewide impact which calls for immediate review by this court. It is the granting of it and the disruption of the state's processes which is incident there too, it seems to me. I would like to say a word about Dallas County. Time is very short. Quite a bit has been said about it. The court has long been troubled, it seems to me, by the tendency to submerge minorities, which is inherent in the size of multi-member districts. Conner against Johnson notes that the single-member district is the preferable model, and in Whitcomb against Chavez, the same note is made, and even earlier in the Lucas case, way back in 1964. The court realizes that the larger the district gets, the more invidious its effects are. Now, here we deal with the largest districts known to exist in the entire country. And if Dallas is number one, may it please the court, Bexar County is number two. At the time of the trial, and heaven knows what it is now, Dallas had 1,327,000 people in it and 500,000 registered voters. Dallas was larger in population than 15 states. 30 United States senators are elected from constituencies which are smaller than that to which a man who wants to sit in the Texas House of Representatives from Dallas, Texas, has to run to. Now, I submit that this situation is intolerable. It might have been otherwise. This is not the case of the great wide open spaces of West Texas, where you have to take in a great deal of land in order to get an ideal district. This is something which could have been and should have been otherwise, and would have been but for the board and its plan. Bexar County is described by Colonel Jaworski as much smaller. It is smaller. It's not quite a million people. It's larger than Rhode Island, 830,460 people. This is still a bracket which is fair-sized, I submit. But if this district, may it please the court, passes First and 14th Amendment muster, then any will, any in the country, and the court's concern with multi-member districts, with the size of districts, is over until Dallas reaches 2 million or 3 million or whatever within a short period of time. In such a district as this, may it please the court, the record shows that although the state law forbids it, the voters had to take cheat sheets with them to the polls, even to remember who it was that they wanted to vote for. It shows that you can't get the number of candidates who are on the ballot on the standard voting machine. There's not enough room. It shows that even the chairman of the DCRG, the dominant political sub-party in Dallas, when he was asked before a legislative committee to name the 15 Democratic legislators from Dallas County, was able to name only five. And that appears in the record as well.
Mr. G., supposing Dallas County were 100% white or 100% Negro, so you didn't have any racial question, would you say there's a constitutional claim simply on the basis of the fact that it's created as a multi-member district?
Mr. Justice Rehnquist, I would. I would because Houston, which is only 200 miles down the pike, has got, if I want to run for the legislature in Houston, I can run to 75,000 people.
Well, would it be an equal protection claim?
Yes, yes,
well, supposing
Your Honor.
Houston, supposing Harris and Bexar and Dallas are all multi-district type of places, so there's no equal protection claim, would you still claim there's any constitutional deprivation?
I think it would be very bad policy to have districts that size, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, but it seems to me that it is the disparate treatment, the selection of different systems of representative government in Texas, which raises the equal protection question.
In your view, how many people should be in a district for the state legislature under the Constitution?
Under the
federal Constitution,
how many people should there be
in a district?
That's very clear, sir. It's
I'm not talking about the federal. I'm talking about the state legislature.
Well, between 74 and 75,000 people, Mr. Chief Justice, that's all we can do. Now, does the Chief Justice refer to a multi-member district?
I'm just talking about districts.
Well,
Mr.
Chief Justice, I don't know what it would be, but I'm satisfied that it ought to be less than 1.5 million. It seems to me that this is out of all reason. It seems to me that under the Chief Justice, the opinion written by the Chief Justice in Bullock against Carter, we have an arraignment of the affluent against the poor under such a system. This record shows that you cannot run effectively in a district the size of Dallas without going to television and radio. And that in Houston, you can. You can campaign on posters and shoelaces.
I thought, Mr. G., going back to my brother Rehnquist's question, that you were making the argument that in a district as big as Dallas, quite apart from how the state treats Houston, and quite apart from any racial discrimination, that you were making the basic argument that in a district as big as Dallas, it violates the Constitution to have multi-member districts. Aren't you making that basic argument?
Mr. Justice Stewart, I certainly am.
If I left the impression that
I was not, I beg Justice Rehnquist's pardon.
Would you mind telling me what section of the Constitution you're talking about?
Equal Protection Clause.
Yes, sir.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, I am, sir.
In spite of
Whitcomb against Chavez and because of Bullock against Carter, Mr. Justice Clark. Now, I would like to say one last word on the subject of the Mann versus Howell, which has just been handed down, and which I think no argument on this subject ought to disregard. In Virginia, a 16% variation was upheld by this court because Virginia had decided to let its counties pass, or its legislature pass, local legislation, as I understand the court's opinion. I would like to point out that under the Texas Constitution, the legislature not only is not authorized to pass local legislation, under the Texas Constitution, the legislature is specifically forbidden to pass local legislation. Article 3, Section 56 of the Texas Constitution states, "The legislature shall not, except as otherwise provided in this Constitution, pass any local or special law authorizing, regulating the affairs of counties, cities, towns, wards, or school districts, locating or changing county seats, incorporating cities, towns, and so forth, creating offices, or prescribing the powers and duties of officers."
Does the Texas legislature ever pass laws dealing with all cities having populations over 1 million or over 1,500,000?
Yes, sir.
Are they sustained by the courts?
They are in some instances, Mr. Justice Rehnquist. We call this bracket legislation, and this is the means whereby the legislature attempts to get around this provision. Sometimes they are if the brackets are broad enough and are open. Legislation with closed brackets, which says cities of so-and-so population, is generally not sustained. It seems to me that this is a valid distinction between Mann against Howell. If county legislation is done by the Texas legislature, it is certainly done in the dark of the moon, and it is frequently invalidated by the Texas Supreme Court. Further, Texas, unlike Virginia, as is indicated by the court's opinion, has not consistently followed a state policy of respecting county lines. In Smith against Craddock, the Texas Supreme Court felt constrained to invalidate a legislative plan enacted by the Texas legislature for its disregard of county lines. And it has not, may it please the court, done so in this case, where 19 counties are cut. I'm confused by the recurring statement that only one county is divided. The record is clear that 19 counties...
Out of how many?
Out of 254, Mr. Justice Rehnquist. 19 counties have been cut, and four of them have been exploded, cut into three pieces, in defiance of the Texas Supreme Court's mandate in Smith against Craig.
How many counties in Texas?
254, I believe.
254, that's correct. The statement is that only one small county has been invaded. And that threw me off, too. It means that only one of the 19 counties that was invaded was a small one.
I think that's what it must be, or it's sometimes described in the brief as a rural one, Mr. Justice, sir.
Thank you, Mr. J. Mr. Jaworski, you have some time left.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. On the jurisdictional question, I think that perhaps the questions that have been asked by members of the court have brought out the basis on which we argued the matter of jurisdiction, and I would merely say to the court that we have cited in our brief the cases that are applicable. We also have undertaken to show to the court that the cases on which the appellees rely are not applicable. Actually, what has been done here has a statewide impact.
Did the state take an appeal, the court of appeals, the protective appeal?
No, sir. No, sir. What happened was that a part of the appeal, you may recall, this court entered a judgment. The appeal that came up from Harris County, you may remember that the court entered a judgment dismissing that part of it, not for lack of jurisdiction, but for other reasons. In any event, this has been fully briefed. I don't think that I need take the time of the court. Actually, I did not see, because of the rule, first, that this actually had statewide impact, but secondly, also the pendant jurisdiction rule, I had not taken the time to really argue that to the court in the original argument. Now, passing on to something else, Mr. Justice Stewart did ask me about the history with respect to Harris County. And it was that history with respect to Houston-Harris County that I undertook to say I was not fully familiar with. The history as to Dallas County has been one consistently of multi-member districts. But as far as Harris County is concerned, I answer that there were flotorial districts in 1965. There were three multi-member districts in 1966, five multi-member districts in 1971. Now, this is the history as the record shows it to be. I merely point that out because Harris County did have some history of some multi-member districts. But it also has a history that really shows more that there has been a division. And when we speak of polls, for instance, in Dallas County in connection with a matter of polls, I think we get into some difficulty because the polls, as we know, if they're going to be polls that relate to how well a candidate is running, they may have some accuracy. But I wasn't referring to polls. I was referring to what had actually been requested of the representatives of the people. And the record shows this. The legislators had made known the wishes with respect to what they wanted in Harris County and also what the situation was as desired in the other counties. Now, with respect to the matter of policy, I don't know where the idea got into the record that there had been any state policy with respect to the matter, Mr. Justice Stewart, that was raised by a question you referred to where the 15 district matter arose. What actually happened was that the limitation was never offered in the state policy. At one time, the House Committee on Congressional and Legislative Districts had felt that multi-member districts should be somewhat limited in size because of the voting machine problem. These changes in the voting machines and the difficulty of getting them and the difficulty of their cost and placing so many of them did raise a question, but this was largely done to accommodate the new change that had been made in the voting machines. The limitation was never offered as a state policy, as this record will show, and there is no indication, as I read the Kilgarland case, that the court assured or was assured that the limitation would be continued in future apportionment plans. This is just simply something that we find unable to follow completely. Then, when we speak of single-member and multi-member districts, or single-member districts throughout the state, in There is an interesting Texas Supreme Court case which we have referred to in our brief. It's the Mosley case, as we often refer to it. And there, the Texas Supreme Court refused to grant the relator's request that the board be ordered to use single-member districts throughout the state. And you'll also find in the Smith versus Craddock case, decided by the Supreme Court of Texas, that there is absolutely nothing found in there. Now, this is a Texas Supreme Court talking about multi-member districts itself. If they found that in any part of the state there was an unfairness with respect to the matter of multi-member districts, I think they would have said so. And consistently, there has been nothing along that line intimated. Now, in Bexar County, I just want to again say this, may it please the court, that what the court said, in effect, the trial court, is we're condemning it not because it operated to dilute or cancel the votes cast by the Mexican-Americans, which I think is the test that we'd want to apply here. What the court said, in effect, is we believe that this way, in the hypothesis and the reasoning that the court applied, we believe this will encourage more Mexican-Americans to vote. Well, of course, this we cannot accept as the test as a criterion in determining the constitutional issues that are before the court here.
Colonel Jaworski,
yes, sir.
I still have a problem between Dallas and Harris County as why one is single and one is multi. I still have trouble with that.
Well, I can just say this to you. If I saw anything in the record at all, anything that showed that it was done as a result of doing more than just seeking to comply with what the legislators had said they thought was appropriate in those districts, then I would have some trouble with it too. But I find nothing.
They could have just as easily told Dallas single member districts, just as easy, couldn't they?
They could have, yes, sir. Except unless you get in some very minutiae, some very great refinements, which very frankly I would not even suggest, although you do have a difference in size. You do have some difference. You would find it perhaps more acceptable in Houston than you would in Dallas County. There is a considerable difference in the size of the two. There's considerable difference in the way the two metropolitan areas actually lie. One is much more compact than the other one. But I just have to frankly say that if there were anything here that suggested that it had been done for the purpose of diluting or canceling strength of any group, I would immediately say that there was a serious question with respect to it, but you just will not find that in the record. And this is why I say that there is nothing, absent something that casts doubt upon it, or that shows that it was done for some ulterior purpose, or that there is some lack of good faith involved, I say that there is nothing to keep a state from having both multi-member and single-member districts in some of its localities. I thank the court.
Thank you, Mr. Jaworski. Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll